So our topic today is gender in the rabbinate. How has the ordination of women changed the role of the rabbi? Currently I'm a solo rabbi. Hopefully this will be the end. Meaning I can go into retirement in God knows how many years. But in Toms River, New Jersey, and after a long time rabbi was there for 31 years. And my favorite question at a Shiva minion is, do we count women in the minion? I'm the rabbi. And I'm like, okay, does that sound obnoxious? But I don't care if it sounds obnoxious. I'm the rabbi. So occasionally they don't even care, but other times they're like, we don't have a minion. I'm like, what are you talking about? Of course we do. So things have changed a little bit, and we had two rabbis with us who share a pulpit together, and they're going to talk about their experiences. Oh, actually, Craig started.
I'm going to start. Yes.
Yeah.
Morning, everybody. Craig Sheff. I was ordained here at the seminary in 1998. It's been commented already how ironic it is that we are in this room today. And I think that Paula's presence where she is right now is a part of the message that we want you to see as how we understand our relationship. I was an attorney before I went to rabbinical school, so I was second career. I practiced law in Massachusetts for 3 years, had my first two children before rabbinical school with my wife Nancy, who works for the National Lamont Commission. She's upstairs. And after 6 years of rabbinical school, I had two more kids. So I have four sons, ages 24, 22, 15, sorry, 16, and 14 and a half. I think that the notion of children in this mix is important because it's a part of our relationship, and very much a part of our rabbinates, our shared rabbinates. So I've been with my synagogue for 20 years. I went there as a student. I came in as a cantor, actually, into the congregation. They needed a shaliach tzibur, and that was my function for the first year. I then became student rabbi and stayed on after ordination, and I've been with that same community for 20 years now. That's my story in very brief.
So I'm Paula Macro. I'm Craig's co-rabbi. I love Ernest Stein. It's my first time in Stein, so I really love what I'm presenting here. I was here at JTS in the 80s studying social work and Jewish studies, and I was here when Amy Eilberg walked across that platform and opened my mind to a new idea that germinated and stayed with me through 12 years in a social work career in New Jersey. I worked with elderly in the geriatric center and then at the Shepherd School that's now become Golda Ock Academy. 12 years into the career, many reasons why I was kick-started into coming back here and starting rabbinical school. You can see the full story. You can't sit over here, it ruins my I made our point.
just another piece of our background. Paula mentioned Rama. I was Roshe Da'at Rama Nayak for 6 years and camp rabbi for 10 years after that. And in between, I was assistant director for 1 year, the year that Paula was program director there. So we had a chance to work together at Rama Nayak before Paula came to the synagogue as intern. The other piece I want to offer...
I worked there for 8 years. You're cutting short by Rama.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Then I became assistant director. I...
And the other piece of our involvement is that I'm also the facilitator for the senior seminar here at JTS for the Rabbinical School and Cantorial School. So to have students here today who are, this is their last session of the year, and next week is finals already. So it's fun to talk about the rabbinate and to help them think about transitioning into the professional world. And I often mention Paula in the context of that class, but it's very rare, and it didn't happen this year, that Paula actually came to that class for us to talk about what we do in the pulpit together. So I'm really thrilled that you get the opportunity to finally meet the lady that I'm talking about all the time.
So Ellen has a lot of questions, but against Craig's advice, which happens really often, I've thought that it would be great to sort of lay out exactly what our point is so that you can have that as a context as Ellen starts asking these questions. And exactly what our point is that balance in Judaism for a very long time consisted of, at best, women on the side and men in the middle, and somehow there was a balance, or women above and men below. But that what Craig and I feel really strongly about is that the balance we've brought not only to each other, not only to our community, but I think to other communities who know about our model, who know us, students we've mentored, who go out into the world with this idea in their mind, is that balance really can be modeling sharing. I'm not the only nurturing one. I'm not the one who cries on the bima. He's not the only hardcore intellectual teacher. I like to teach hard stuff too. So all the kind of places that people try to categorize the male rabbi, the female rabbi, he sings better than I do, right? So that's our point, that balance is really a sharing in the center and less about gender roles than about finding a way for both of us to find our voice.
And I think that in the spirit of full disclosure, you know, we're tackling an issue today that I think we can speak to in a very nice, instructive way. On the other hand, there are certain things that are very particular to our situation that I understand takes us out of the club and makes us a little bit more particular in the type of relation that we've been able to have. The mere fact that Paula does not live in our community, but commutes to work every day and lives in our home on Shabbat for the last 13 years with her family, for most Shabbatot of the year, says something about who we are and what we've been able to do together that we understand not everybody can do. My wife, Nancy, and her husband, John, the Rebbetzin and the Rebbetzman, and they carry those titles proudly, they love each other. And I'm her husband's rabbi, and she's friends with Nancy, and it doesn't work if that doesn't happen. And we recognize that. The other piece of our background is that we're at a synagogue that, when I came to the synagogue, it was 230 families. It grew very quickly. We're 500 families now, but it grew very quickly to 400. We made a determination at that point that we really wanted Paula there. We're now at 500, and we're very stable in a sea of communities in a sea of synagogues that struggle to be stable. And we recognize that, but we also believe that it's partly a function of our partnership and the model that we set for leadership, that people feel that sense of stability in that tumultuous sea.
But we do think that there's takeaway that people can use, or else we wouldn't be sitting here. We just didn't want to do show and tell with Ellen. We really think that there are pieces of our model that are applicable.
And I think
we're
going to leave a couple minutes at the end.
Yeah, we
want to have a question.
Oh, absolutely.
And one thing that we didn't plan before, because now looking at everybody, I'm just curious to get a sense of everybody. How many people are in a partnership in their current, in where they are? And then how many people are looking towards getting a partner where they are? And a working partner.
Okay. And I would include Cantors.
Yeah.
And I would include Cantors in the category of a partner here as well. That it, this isn't just about two rabbis. This
no,
is about
exactly. That's why I tried to use my words.
Yeah.
I tried to, carefully. So how did you create a partnership, a partner relationship or Ezer Kenigdo relationship and divide the responsibilities?
Paula came into our community as an intern, and in that internship, there were certainly things that she wanted to explore and grow, and there were areas that I needed some help, but it was always my giving her the space to dictate what she wanted to do, so that once she established her chassidim, in a sense, then it was just go with it. I was always of the opinion that she should just explore the areas that, that Paula wanted to explore. And by pursuing her passions, she would add to the kinds of things that our community was offering. There was never a division of labor. There was never a, well, you have a background in geriatrics and you know, and I have grandparents. So you take chazak and I'll stick with the kids. Because I'm younger than her, which I am. I always remind her of that.
20 minutes!
Yes, she's the senior in years. But it was never a matter of dividing the labor between us. It was about simply partnering in everything from the beginning and about doing the things that each of us wanted to do. We loved to play, and we wanted to play with the kids. And we wanted to play with the seniors, and we wanted to play in adult education, and it was never my saying, here's what I'm teaching this year, now you tell me how you're going to fill in the gaps.
I use the word Ezer Kenigdo very consciously because our congregation, perhaps, or maybe most people, wanted there to be a hierarchy. I came from his side. I came in as the associate. I came in first as the intern, and in my internship year, I did, and we have several interns, graduated interns sitting here. I followed him around to just watch what he did and to learn from him. So it was set up that way. But once I was really working there, it really became that interpretation of Ezer Kenigdo, opposite, mirroring, being able to call each other on things, which, yes, is a function of our already in place friendship. But also, I think, has to do with something all of us are capable of, which is looking at ourselves and saying, can I let go of the ego? Can I just want what's best for my community instead of what's best in terms of how I look to the community? And I have to say, you know, it was Craig's show before I got there, and he took that synagogue that people told him not to go to, and he went there, and he turned it around. But once I came, it was never like, oh no, I'm losing my grasp on being the beloved. Maybe there could be two beloveds to the congregation. And so I think it's in all of us. And by the way, both of us are extremely competitive people. Like, don't play Scrabble with me on Shabbat afternoon. But we're competitive for what is best for the Jews. So...
we're taking questions now at the end.
We didn't talk about that.
Yeah, we did. We said at the end. Do you want to take them
at the end? Jonathan, could you hold your question for the end? Okay.
Jot it. Don't forget it.
Yeah. So some of us over the years may have experienced a assistantship, associateship, where the person who was there previously didn't want the new colleague or another colleague to do life cycle events. It was their territory. I guess the ego comes in with that. Has that ever been a situation where people say, I can't have that female rabbi doing the funeral? Or
It still happens, very rarely, but it still happens. I'll share with you, we're going through a situation right now where a young lady grew up in our community, day school. I've known her since she's 5 years old, and she's getting married. And she wants us both at that wedding. She's marrying a young man whose family belongs to Chabad. And the father has made it clear, kol isha, no women's voices. And as much as it hurts the bride because she wants a more egalitarian wedding, she's willing to cede this desire to her husband's family, or husband-to-be's family, because that's what's going to get them through the day. But she knows that it hurts us also. And I know that it hurts Paula. The fact that I don't want to say I'm not going to do this wedding. This is a close family. I love this family and I love this girl like a daughter. But I also know that she's in pain. And we process that together. We talk about it and about how to manage that and what to what degree Paula participates, if at all. Does she take a stand and say, you know what, you don't want to hear my voice? I'm out of this. And that's a process of negotiation. With funerals, at first it happened more. People didn't want to have the woman do the service. And then first I made it clear that I will not do funerals on Mondays. Mondays are my day off. Paula's on Mondays. And if somebody dies on a Friday or a Saturday and there's going to be a funeral on Monday, well then guess what? I'm not doing the service. I might show up. I might participate even. But it's not mine. It's Paula's. And there were some families who would say, well, can I wait? Or, well, then I'm going to get somebody else because I have an Orthodox family member who says that I can't do this. Well, at first that happened for a little while. And with time, it stopped. It's very rare. Once a year it happens, maybe.
The most recent time it happened, it's always because of Aunt Gertrude. It's never because of what I feel. But Aunt Gertrude's coming from Nebraska, and she would, the last time it happened, I went and paid a shiva call. Anyway, of course. I mean, I think I always would have. And she really wanted to talk about it and how she felt that through the process, she had learned something. And so there was like a healing there for her. A different kind of way, though, that we do draw lines. Because sometimes in life cycle stuff, that's just what happens. And that is when we talk about it.
Before you give your example, I just want to give one other life cycle example, and that is the Shiva Minyan. Yeah. So we have a family who had Orthodox family members, they were sitting Shiva together, and they didn't want to count women in the Minyan. So we made it clear, even in our message to the community, these people are observing Shiva, they are running the Minyan. It's not our Minyan. So if they're not going to count women in the Minyan, it's not our Shiva Minyan. What they do in the privacy of their home is their business. If we drop by to pay a shiva call, that's our choice. But we're not going to have the name of our synagogue attached to a shiva minyan that's not going to count women. It's just not something that we'd accept.
Okay. That's a good point. In the community, when there's community-anchored programs, then Craig will absolutely refuse to participate but if I'm not invited, Craig won't participate at all. So that kind of line has rippled into our board of rabbis, where basically everyone says, Ariel Russo, who's my colleague now in the county, and Paula, participate, or you can't put board of rabbis' name on it, which is, of course, a great alliance. But it really started, I think, with modeling here. Like, we won't participate.
We have an issue in our community with the ultra-Orthodox in East Ramapo. You might have heard of it.
Maybe you've heard of it.
And so to try to establish dialogue is really hard. To get people to come to a table is very difficult. So we were called by the county executive's office to sit on an interfaith committee. And they called Paula first. And Paula said, I might be a non-starter here. If I'm on this committee, you might not get anybody from that community to come and to talk. So the organizer referred the question to Joe Potasnik and then called me to sit on the committee. And when he called me, he asked me what my opinion was. I said, it's plain and simple. If Paula can't sit at this table, I'm not sitting at this table. She's not the non-starter. They're the non-starter. You know how, if they're going to sit and not call her rabbi, I don't care about that. If they're not willing to sit at a table, I know you do, but you were willing to step out of it.
Yeah.
For the sake of the conversation.
Yeah.
And I was not willing for you to step out of that for the sake of the conversation. If there's going to be any healing, any dialogue, she has to be part of the conversation. Otherwise, what's the point of having that conversation?
And we don't know yet.
It's next Wednesday. We'll see.
They haven't called me back yet.
We're both going.
You both going?
And Craig,
you're, I'm not going.
You're a great example of why our celebration is with men. Because we need more supportive colleagues like you. Mm-hmm. And hopefully, I think they are out there. I do believe. Two questions. One is how you figure out who's going to, I'm assuming you address all the commandments for children. How you figure out who does that. And my next question is, since you spoke about the issue of minyan, any other halachic issues that have arisen because of having a woman in the clergy team now?
All right. You want to talk about
the bar mitzvah? Yeah. So hold on to your seats. Put your seatbelt on. Craig and I train all the bar mitzvah kids ourselves. So whoever trained the student is the one who charges them, and the other does the mishabeach. Craig is the sixth grade religious school teacher, along with whoever our intern is that year, and I have a co-teacher. I'm the seventh grade teacher. Yay, Edgar, Shelley. Okay. And we feel like that is a really hard use of our time. Like, when it's a vacation week, we're both like, whoa, this is incredible not having religious school this week. But we're in the classroom, and then we're training them for B'nai Mitzvah, so the charge is to our intimate kids. Like, and that's not, then it's not hard. It's whoever trained them. It works out with a perfect balance that way.
And that commitment plays out in our retention rate after bar mitzvah.
What about because when you have chazan?
He used to do some of the training. I did less than, and I was there.
By training, you mean all the Torah reading, not just the Divrei Torah, you mean all the Torah.
The year.
And 10 months.
10 months of
10 months
tutoring.
In the rabbi's office.
Tutors as well, or do you do all the tutors?
We do
all the tutors.
Occasionally, with the there's parents some, for the meeting.
Right. Occasionally, somebody needs some extra help, and we'll bring in an outside tutor. But we do all the students.
Yeah.
Just a question.
So can you say? So we should take Jonathan's question then.
Yeah. Sorry.
Maybe she just take the question.
Is that yeah, I
more
think so.
Jonathan, what was your question?
Tapas. Your compensation, not the numbers. Are you getting the same compensation?
Nope.
Is it appropriate, or are they nope. shortchanging you because you're
yep.
shortchanging him because he's whatever it is? That's the bottom line. That's the bottom line. The show only sees you as equals.
Yes.
So I'll answer it this way. We revisit this conversation annually every time the budget comes out. We are conscious of the inequality. We make sacrifices. Both of us feel, I mean, we all feel shortchanged, right? We're all worth more than we're getting paid. So we make sacrifices for the situations that we have. We rationalize by saying, I've been there 6 years longer. You know, the community turned around with my leadership, whatever the case may be. But ultimately, we know that there's an inequality there. And the inequality was greater when we had a chazan because there was another salary to be paid. And now we only have a two-rabbi model without a chazan, so there were resources to lessen the inequality, but it's there. And the synagogue will say, you know, you're the key employee. You know, you live in the community. They make all kinds of rationalizations, too. Do we assign it to gender? I don't. Do you assign it to gender?
I do.
Wait, did you think of pulling your salaries and cutting them in half? I'm not saying it's a real suggestion.
She told me not to. I offered.
My question is how far?
She buys the meat for Shabbat.
In a perfect world, there are ways of...
Yeah.
Is this the realistic expectation, or is this, you know, if that isn't real? Or is that where someone should go?
Yeah.
Let's go.
Jonathan, it's really important questions, and we actually were talking about this last night, like how are we going to handle this conversation. It tends to be, obviously, like, you know, it brings your heart up into your throat as you start talking about it. And, you know, as someone who grew up as a follower of Leti Kotel Pogrebin, I always feel like in some way I'm letting down the women's movement that put me here in the first place by being one of those statistics that shows that men are compensated at a higher level than women for the same work. On the other hand, I'm very conscious that this is a community that, with incredible foresight, who has 400 family members and says, oh, I think we'll have two rabbis. Uh-huh. They just saw that what I was bringing was so complementary to what they already had in place and saw if we were going to move forward, they wanted me. So they carved out, without the resources, this thing for me. And then when it was time to renegotiate, they literally restructured. And I felt like part of that process, they did what they could at the time. So Craig's family and my family, in many ways, operate as one marching unit. I don't want to overstate it, but, you know, like, our kids think they're related somehow. They're not exactly sure that there's really two separate families. It's been a long time now. And I care very much about Craig's family. So the idea of, like, pooling, like, would Craig give back to bring me up to snuff? I think, I'm just going to be as honest as I can be. I think in some ways we just look at the net income of both families and say, okay, my family can afford my less salary because my husband makes more than Nancy does. We're really intimate that way, and I think in the end, it comes out in the laundry. The other thing I will say, while it's like sort of like, last night I said to Craig, I feel like it's L'Hatchila and the day of, like, from the beginning, it's not good that I have less money, but when I look at it after, it's what's in place, and I've raised a family of four kids to say, when you go to work, you know, I'm sure you say this to your kids too, or your family, your partner. It's so important to want to go do what you're doing. That's what's really priceless. And so I know I could be making more, but I couldn't be having more soul compensation than what I have. And getting to work with him, I'll say it in front of him, is priceless. So
you say that the dollars aren't the only way, aren't the sole standard of value. There's much more that goes into all this conversation.
Right.
And I don't know your name.
Mira. Mira Rivera. So I actually wanted to know that some of the sharing and the salary. So.
Oh, so that was exactly the question.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for.
And I'll share your name.
Oh, I'm Annie Lewis from Philadelphia. I'm really excited to hear this because I've been an assistant rabbi for 3 years and just committed to stay on, and my senior rabbi and I are trying to find a model for what a partnership could look like moving forward, so this is incredibly helpful. I'm curious to hear if you take different roles as far as the political work of the organization and the board and the executive committee, if you how you share those responsibilities.
So I'm wondering if before I answer that, if we could just come back to the question that was asked about the second part of your question, Ellen, was
the halakhic issue.
Oh, the halakhic issue.
But so, I'll write down your question.
Thank you.
So let me answer that one first with an example of what we went through in a transition time, because the transition time is a lot more interesting than what is today, quite honestly. And when Paula came aboard, that was really the time that we were moving toward imahot in the tefillah. And we were not, we were egalitarian, but we were not imahot in the tefillah. And somebody in our community was really agitating for change. And she really wanted me to bring this issue to the ritual committee. And I knew that Paula was coming in and that we were really trying to create this space for Paula. And I realized that trying to bring in imahot at the same time that Paula was going to be transitioning into the community was strategically really not the way to go. Because I knew that people would assign the change to her instead of seeing the change for what it was meant to be. So I said to that person and her group, please just be patient. Let's have this transition first and then come to the halakhic issue. And it worked beautifully because Paula was in and then she was part of the education process. We did a year of education with the ritual committee. We did a year of programs with the community. It was a big discussion. Talk about, you know, moving. Paula wrote this beautiful poem that really moved the community about her prayer and her feeling about the imahot. And it touched me very deeply. And it's just part of the process of helping to make a halakhic change, but in the right time, in the right space, with the right education process. Not making it about, oh, this is a gender thing. We didn't want it to be about that. So that's the example of halakha that I wanted to offer.
Want me to talk about executive?
Sure, go ahead.
So a great thing about having two rabbis is it's half as many meetings. Right. So 1 month I go to executive committee and Craig goes to trustees, and then the next month we flip. Someone's always there. We take turns with ritual committee, so every other month. And
And we both meet with the president monthly before the executive committee.
Together, all three of us. So and our president is amazing and visionary in many, many ways, but he is a business guy who is so hierarchical, and it has been a slow process, which I feel like we've had a lot of success in telling him I'm not the assistant note taker here. So even though he loves and respects me, it was hard because he just has a hierarchical mind, and Craig's the boss.
Pardon? When's his term up?
Another year, but
he's really
been a learner, and he's been great. So, but what I wanted to say, interestingly, in terms of expected gender roles, is that I'm...
older.
I don't know what he's going to say to me on the way home. I, as a social...
We came in separate cars.
Yeah, but that's right, good. As a social worker by training, and with that social work model in my head, I want to get in and get dirty with all the stuff going on in terms of the politics and the committee work and the finding volunteers to do stuff and, you know, identifying who would be great for what, and I have to sit on my hands and stop myself from talking at board meetings and remember, like, I'm here. It's been a learning process for me. And Craig has a very different tact. And so
I rein her in. I literally pull her back sometimes, say, stay out of that. You don't want to go there.
Right.
I consider myself the more strategic thinker, so I tend to see things a little differently. And my leadership style has changed a lot in 20 years from a congregation of 230 where I was involved in everything, every program, every piece of mail that went out from the shul, realizing that you have to step back, you have to make room for it to run itself, and Paula just loves the dynamics of getting involved in the conversations, and I'd much prefer it to happen and talk to me later about it if there's an issue.
A question.
I want to know if there were issues that come up in terms of during the transition or even now, do congregants automatically assume that one of you will be more liberal than the other, or were there issues of it? They'll say, I'm going to go to the male rabbi, I'm going to go to the female rabbi, because that issue.
Paula set the tone when she got up on her first Rosh Hashanah and gave a sermon about homosexuality. Boom.
Rosh Hashanah.
I mean, first year there, you know, her first foray into speaking to the community, and everyone assumed that...
It wasn't 2 years ago, it was.
And everyone assumed immediately that she was gay. So, you know, that's just the way it goes, right?
Not that there's anything wrong.
No, and it's part of this dynamic where... I would say that there are people who see issues that way, but Dex is a different way also. People go to Paula because they sense a certain way of listening, and they sense a different way of listening from me. And the same person may choose to go to Paula for a topic that's sensitive to them, that they just feel like she's the person to speak to. It's very individual. And the next week they'll come to me to speak about something else.
Do you think that was always the case, or is that something that's transitioned? Because I know we're contemporary. So, I know when we started out, there was a lot of times that people didn't get the answer they wanted. So for people who don't know us, we're two rabbis, we don't work together, but we're married to each other. And if people didn't like the answer that Sean gave, they wanted a more liberal answer, they would often say, well, I'll go in the back door and I'll go through Jen, and then discover that Jen was actually the more mostly conservative of the two of us.
Yeah.
And so wait a minute, I'm really undermining my argument here. So I was wondering, I know
that
we were also in a military environment, which in itself is very hierarchical.
Mm-hmm.
And can I get another question? So if there is a halachic decision that needs to be made, who's Maradatra?
So I'm the designated Maradatra. And, that does create a situation of a little bit of a feeling of hierarchy. But the truth is that we don't make very many decisions without speaking to each other. And this isn't a gender thing. This is a partnership thing. I think that this should apply to all of us. That is that if there's a sensitive topic, I'm going to usually say, let me think about that, and then I'll discuss it with her.
I think the other answer to that is that everything I learned from Rabbi Lebo about boundaries, which is really important and valuable, I'm not so good at. So people, and I, he's always, I don't know how many of you have Rabbi Lebo on your shoulder.
Always.
Whispering in my ear. Or yelling at me or something. But I would say that people feel like they know us both really personally. And one thing they know is that we have a partnership in our synagogue where we talk about everything, except when we're counseling in our offices, and it's been proven that that is very safe. Very often people will hear one of us say, I'd like to share this with Rabbi Sheff. Is that all right? I want to make sure he knows that this is going on with you. And almost always the answer is yes. In fact, most often I would say people say to me, I just want you to know that I went to Rabbi Sheff about that and I don't. And our stock answer, which is absolutely true, is there is no territory here. You need to come to a rabbi and talk about things. I do think that the things that we talk about when we're giving a drash then affects who comes to us. I tend to talk about issues, mental illness, breast cancer awareness, domestic violence prevention, the things that I'm very passionate about. Then, obviously, after that sermon, people are going to start calling me about that. But that doesn't mean that people aren't going to Craig also about domestic violence issues. And if he feels like it's something that I can handle, he'll refer. And if he's good with it, he just takes it from there. We have the same referral lists and the same basic knowledge. We both tend to try to learn a lot all the time. So
Michael Fell from Lexington, Massachusetts. Four quick questions. Quick answer. The question itself. One. How do you handle when people ever critique one of you to the other? And how do you handle that?
Triangulate mom and dad.
Right. So number two, how often do you two meet, like just the two of you, to talk about catch up on school stuff? Like in a formal context, not just informally. Paternity leave and maternity leave, how is that different for you guys? Or in your organization, and how do you handle speaking, public speaking in the synagogue in terms of Rosh Hashanah sermons, Yom Kippur, etc.?
Wow. Do you remember all the questions?
So we'll go backwards. So Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we've been doing this way. When Paula first started, you did one sermon, right?
I was still in Kabul doing High Holidays.
Right, but when you started coming to the shul, you would do, one of the sermons. At this point in time, Our sort of rhythm is that Paula speaks at Kol Nidre, I speak Yom Kippur morning. We both speak with our two services at our shul. So I speak first day in the main service. Paula is in the parallel service with my son, the Shaliach Tzibur, on the first day. And then second day, we flip-flop. And
we flip-flop the service entirely, by the way. So it doesn't look like one rabbi is in the main sanctuary and the other rabbi is parallel. We both do both services.
Right. So we're fortunate we only have to write one sermon each for Rosh Hashanah. What's the next question?
What was the
maternity? We're going backwards. Maternity
and paternity leave.
We didn't have to deal with that. We were past that stage of our lives, so we never really discussed it. Though it's certainly interesting to consider what will be someday for the community. And we hope that the model has been established for the community. We rewrote our constitution a year ago, and the language of the constitution was so important to negotiate because it started out with the rabbi, and then it was everybody else. And it was so hierarchical, and we fought hard to make sure that the language reflected a partnership in the clergy, even if it's going to be cantor rabbi, that there was partnership in the clergy as opposed to the idea that one rabbi is overseeing the work of the other clergy members. That just wasn't a model that we wanted set in stone for the future of the community.
But we are in a synagogue that's been educated first by Craig and now by me for sabbatical. So I have to imagine it would be with thought toward the health of the rabbi and his or her family. So Craig had a sabbatical. I have one coming up. Craig will have another one. So it's a community that I think gets that we have private lives also.
And they do cherish that. They cherish our family life balance. So I think it plays into this issue, the idea, just that they want to make sure that we're taking care of ourselves.
How often do you meet?
We don't ever not meet. We're just talking all the time.
I tell her not to call me on Monday. She tells me not to call her on Wednesdays. Those are our days off. We do anyway. I try really hard not to message her on her day off, but sometimes it happens. Again, because we don't want to be making important decisions that are independent of each other. and she always contributes something important for me to consider. Just for the way I come at something, to have her opinion is really valuable.
And lastly, triangulation.
Triangulation.
Yeah. So I'll try to think of one. She said it sounds rosy. Do we have disagreements?
Right.
Okay. So people have tried. And I would say, I think in any community you're going to have people who are going to need to try to grasp at relationships or power. And in every situation, we've just sent them back to the person. After that infamous sermon on homosexuality, I received about 50 phone calls and emails thanking me for saying the word lesbian in the synagogue where they thought they would never hear themselves affirmed. And there were about 6 or 7 people who were very distraught by my sermon for a variety of reasons. And of those 6 or 7, I was new. 5 of them went to him. And each time, Craig counseled them to speak with me. So it's pretty hard to do that triangulation when the two rabbis are united, like the parents are a united front. So I think that I can count on one hand the times people have written trying to tell me that he's been, like, not nice or he did the wrong thing and whatever, and I've always taken it back to him, either telling them, go talk to him. If you can't, can you give me permission to talk to him so he knows what's going on so that he can solve this with you?
And we have one con here who is simply a nudnik who will complain about anything that she does. And one, really one, who will complain about anything that she does.
No, plenty of complainers, just this one, no matter what I do.
Email me on a regular basis telling me what she has done to bother him, and, you know, we've learned to dismiss that.
Semicolon in the wrong place in my blog, you know, things like
that. Seriously, and he's a stickler for all kinds of things that we don't value the same way. But I say to him, either you're willing to speak to her directly, or you have to live with your issue. And that's just the way it goes.
Hi. I'm sorry for you here with us. You've spoken a lot about modeling, which I think is the best way to educate a community. And I'm curious how you might instruct rabbis, individual rabbis, or partners of partnership rabbis where there is not a female rabbi, where they can also educate their community.
Where there is not a female rabbi.
So it's two men working together.
And you want to educate the community regarding what?
Gender balance.
Gender balance, or
balance, yeah.
Or just the checking of the ego and making room for the other?
No, in particular instance, gender balance.
Gender balance, there's two more.
Or two female
rabbis,
that would be very helpful.
Yeah, I mean, that's true.
I always think, I actually don't know that there is in place yet a woman who is a senior rabbi.
There was one.
Right.
It wasn't successful.
Yeah, associate assistant male rabbi. So I don't think that's a place. So there are other models. Obviously, there are married couples who are rabbis together and things like that. And Billy, you guys work too. I would say that in terms of modeling, one way that you have the most powerful teaching tool is with your voice and what you choose to speak about. So if there are two men, but those men attach themselves to issues of gender equality and attach themselves to those kinds of things that people think of as not, you know, in the male, within the typical standard old-fashioned male gender identity, then you're going to open up that community and women are going to feel like they are acknowledged and heard by the man who's talking. So there's no reason why, actually, just most recently, so this year I did domestic violence abuse awareness, and the year before it was Christ. You know, he spoke about it. So if I weren't in place, I was a man, it would still be addressed in the community, which I think is a modeling of there are issues that are for men and women. And by the way, obviously domestic violence is an issue for men as well, but the proportions are so different.
I also think that there's female leadership in the community aside from the rabbinate. Mm-hmm. And so whether it's your youth director or your education director or your synagogue president, or committee chairs to be able to recognize that we want to create spaces for each of those individuals to be empowered to have their voices heard is another way of modeling that behavior. And reinforcing that in the synagogue in front of the community is very viable in different ways. So I would imagine that that's another way to approach it.
Can I address that? Because I think that there's if you're a sole rabbi of trying to make sure that those issues are covered, like you mentioned domestic violence, or specific examples like Sisterhood Shabbat is not always about Asian Kaya. You know, when we first moved to Toronto, Sean was the assistant for Robert Freeman Cole at that center, a huge person. The sisterhood came and said, would you mind if Rabbi Gorman speaks for Sisterhood Shabbat? And they neglected to say the first name. They neglected to say Jennifer. And Baruch said, very purposefully, came to me and said, this request came through. I don't want you to be the woman rabbi. I want you to speak on a completely different Shabbat. Sean spoke. He's like, I'm using their omission against them to teach them a lesson. You know? And so maybe it's you have leadership, and to say there are female leadership roles, give them opportunity to speak on the Shabbat, not necessarily the Shabbat Shira.
And there was a danger of that when Paula first started. There was that danger. I could see it happening, that the sisterhood was just seizing onto her for everything. Whereas before, they invite me. And all of a sudden, I wasn't getting invited anymore. I was very jealous. Very jealous.
So is that
it demanded.
Was domestic violence. So he didn't beat her up the Russian language with Sister Shabbat. We're going to make everything nice. It's like, we're going to address issues. I think if you're the sole rabbi, to make sure that the issues of gender inequality are addressed, and those things are paid attention to.
I want to insert a question that Ellen, I know this other question,
right.
But Ellen had just written me a note and said, like, what about points of disagreement? Because it all sounds so rosy. And I think if it sounds so rosy, it's going to feel impossible, or it's going to feel like not applicable. And the truth is that I think that there is healthy disagreement about lots of issues, but it's never argument. It's really, our model is discussion. There's plenty of things that I drive him crazy about, and I, you know, whatever it might be, I always feel like we have so long ago instituted this model of conversation versus discord and disagreement that it works out pretty well. And most of the time, it's issues, when I think about it, and it's like I didn't think about it as I sat down today, but when I think about those issues that have been the hardest, it's been around gender identity issues. It's been around that Shiva minion. It's been around work in the county with, you know, the ultra-Orthodox who won't acknowledge me. It's been around Sisterhood Shabbat, like, you know, with Greg pouting, during Shabbat, and saying, like, well, like, I might as well, like, not even be here. Like, I'm the rabbi, too. Like, what's that? And I had to, whatever.
Contract negotiations
were very hard, as Jonathan brought up, and as then we went forward. And one of my negotiations, I just had the total wrong committee to do it. It was a pretty disastrous from beginning to end, and I didn't handle it so well. But that wasn't disagreement between us. I was just shrying to you all the time. So
I'm struggling to think of an issue where you and I disagreed over something that sent me home saying, you know, I got to get through to her. You know, it's not that. We just don't let it get there.
We do operate differently sometimes, and I think that leads us to a little bit of friction, like taking something head on or trying to work through it more slowly. So I always want to go to the heart of the matter, and it's hard to, as Craig said, put the reins on me sometimes to think it through. Like, just one kind of funny example is when this business started coming to our awareness with regard to East Ramapo, and please all of you go back if you haven't, listen to the NPR, This American Life on East Ramapo. It's really important for everyone to know what's going on. And I wanted to go march through Muncie with a sign saying, I am a Jew too. Like, I was like, ready to... And Craig was like, you know, getting tomatoes thrown at you is not the way to affect change. And so, which was really true and really important for me to think about. So I would say the disagreements bubble up in difference in style, perhaps. Right. And then we discuss, and I think both of us have changed a lot in these years. Both of us have.
Yes, we're going to go down the road, but just identify yourself.
I'm Joel Schwab, president of Middletown, New York. The thing that I've always admired about the relationship, as seen from fairly up close, has been this ability the two of you to give and take. You relate to each other without ego in the vast majority because you are both so concentrated on the holy work that we do, and that just made things, life in the congregation so wonderful. And is a great model for all of us as two professions. But what it's not, what I've never thought of in your relationship and the way that you've done things, is that it has to do with your genders. It has to do with your personalities as Craig and Paula, not the fact that one of you is male and one of you is female. My question to you, which I've never had a chance to talk to, you, to either of you about, is do you see in the work that you do, things that are specifically gender, that come from your genders? Is there something, and I direct this mostly to Craig, is there something in what Paula brings to the congregation and to you that has been an impact because she is a woman?
Thank you for those beautiful words.
Yeah, thank you, Joel.
We all in the region.
I think that the example that I can point to that is really gender related, I think you're right, that a lot of this is not about gender. It's just about it's about personal style and recognizing that we're building something, that there's plenty of love to go around. And the more successful she is, the more successful I am. The more successful I am, the more successful she is. And it feeds, the happiness of the community feeds off of that. And the community buys into it also in the way they treat each other. So I think that's really important to see as well. Paula started it's a girl thing in our shul several years ago, a Rosh Chodesh group for teens. And it was really successful. She wrote about it, and she published an article about it, and it was just a beautiful way to bring young women in the community together. That was successful in its time. I will tell you that right now we have a Rosh Chodesh group for moms raising young kids who are getting together and crying together about raising their children and discovering elements of Judaism that are touching them in a way that's really bringing an awakening to them and to this cohort and to the community as a result. I couldn't have done that. It would not have been something that I could have accessed. And I can point to several things over the years that she's been able to access that I simply never could. And, you know, on a stereotypical level, I could say it's gender-based. But then on an actual level, I could say it's gender-based also. You know, she can go into someone's home and have tea in a way that I can't. And I think part of that is gender-based. When you're visiting a 60-year-old woman going into her home and having tea with her, that's not something that I would do. But Paula can do that.
Do you think that in your teaching, your preaching, your sermonizing, your scholarship has been, in some sense, gender?
Without a doubt. I pointed to the issue of the poem. What was the title of the poem you wrote for Praying with the
Mother? Praying with Our Mothers.
Praying with Our Mothers. You know, her experience has opened me up to seeing issues in a certain way that while I consider myself very sensitive, I grew up with three sisters, I'm attuned to the needs of women, I think, as much as a man can be, and yet I think that she's opened me up to seeing texts and to breathing in a certain way that is more based in her gender. I think it has been too
And as moderator, can I throw a question in here?
Yeah, I just wanted to also add to Joel's question. Just this, we have a very big question in our synagogue about covering our heads. And I am one woman rabbi who feels strongly about women covering heads. And I know that there's debate on it, but this is my feeling. And we've been in a long process, 3 years now, and started again of education through the ritual committee of a decision within the religious school. Bang, at the beginning of the school year, everyone is covering their heads, boys and girls and their teachers. And then rolling it into our ritual life, where if a woman takes a leadership role, whether it's floor gabbai or giving announcements or opening the ark, their heads are all covered. Kids coming on the bima for Adon Olam, their heads are covered. It has been an extremely difficult issue with our, you can imagine, with our teenage girls mostly, the pushback. But here I feel like my role as a woman, with my head coverings, modeling it, has allowed us to move it forward. That when people come as guests, they often comment how many women in our community wear tallit and kippah. But it's like, those of you who know me know my shtick. I owe it. Like, I don't do pocketbook and shoes. I do kippah to match. It's always well done. And I know men are less conscious of matching kippah to tie or whatever. So it's there. I know. But there's a playfulness and an allowance among the women who take a lot of pride. They'll introduce me to their cousin who came to shul. This is Rabbi Drill. Look at how her kippah matches. But the ultimate play of that, the ultimate rollout of that, is that our younger girls totally buy into it. And they're going, in a serious level, they're going to grow up thinking, of course I cover my head. Of course I do. So, and Craig wears a kippah, but I don't think he would have been model for girls and older women in that way.
And by the way, I'm a man who believes in women wearing kippah. From an education perspective, I don't understand how that's not the case, because we have to be honest with our kids who ask the question, well, why does he and I don't? And to me, there's no good answer to that except you should. So we're together in this issue very much. But she models something that I could not model in this discussion.
So that's a great segue to one of my questions that I had. First was, if more girls and women have been wearing tefillin now that you're there to be a model. And I know it's with difficulty with boys too. And if are any of you the seniors, are you responsible for that great video, the comments, if they were made to men, like they're made to guys? None of you? So I'm curious if there are other comments that they make to you because you're a woman, or not to you, or like, I don't know if you wear pants on the bima.
That video did not impress me.
Craig and I get the same things.
They get the same comments.
They talk about his beard.
They talk about my beard during the Omer. They talk about my clothing. They talk about my haircut. They talk about, a few years ago they talked about my baby face. It's less so now. Less so now, but thanks. But no, we get comments, and I think that comes with familiarity.
Right. I think it's about
we created an air where the boundaries between us and our congregants are low, and so they feel comfortable saying these things. And sometimes they're downright inappropriate. But I've had as many inappropriate comments as she had, as I would say.
Interesting. Nice to hear your ego.
And the tefillin issue.
We struggle with tefillin. I don't know if anyone. That's another session, right? We just struggle with tefillin in general. We just had a Rosh Chodesh bat mitzvah, and Craig trained this girl, and he spoke with the family and said to the dad and the older brother, who I trained for bar mitzvah and tefillin. They looked at him like he was crazy. The dad did put on tefillin, but I don't think he will for another whatever. It's an issue.
I have the guests that go on the bima too after work, Kippa?
Yes.
Yeah.
Our floor gabbai is on that. Yeah. I several years ago did push much harder around tefillin. We do a bar mitzvah packed program, parents and children together, and in previous years we've done a a Tefillin workshop with everybody. I certainly model Tefillin, but that's an issue for our future, I think. That's just in our community.
By the way, Paula mentioned PACT. There are a lot of programs that we double team.
Yeah.
And I think in a lot of places, the feeling would be, well, what's the point of putting both of you on the same program? But to us, it's really important to have that connection with families and bringing our own unique perspectives to the experience and the connections that we make with families. We both want the opportunities, so we don't have to compete for something. We do it together.
And honestly, sometimes we do visits for Bikur Cholim together. If we have to schlep into the city, we might say, okay, let's do this Thursday after he's done teaching, whatever. If it's a really hard visit, like a really heartbreaking visit, we might do it together just for the support and the having been there together. And then, of course, having two rabbis allows you to make sure someone is seen more often. So and that's just case by case.
And they don't complain that Craig came and you didn't, or you came and he didn't. They're...
Not really. Occasionally you'll drop me a reminder.
Yes, sometimes. Yeah, sometimes, but not the norm.
Would that be because they perceive you as a senior because you've been there longer, or is it a gender issue?
Sometimes it's a personal connection issue. Sometimes it's the longevity thing. I mean, I also grew up in the community. So my personal connections run a little bit deeper. I grew up in a shul 10 minutes away. My wife became bat mitzvah in the shul where I'm rabbi okay. now.
His in-laws are our congregants, go figure.
Yeah, so there's a lot there, and there are just certain families who expect that they're mishpacha. You know, right? You can't convince them that they're not.
Yeah. And Ravid, I think, was...
Yeah, well, I actually want to rewind a little bit to a quote. I guess that's what happened. I just want to rewind a little bit to when you guys were really starting to work together. You've been talking about the journey. So I understand that you guys knew each other in advance, so maybe that changes things a little bit. But I guess more to you, Craig, in terms of trust, like how, what was it that you said? We're going to be equal partners from the beginning, and Paula's your titles are going to change, or is it that were you guarded in thinking, you know what, I need to be at the top of the hierarchy, and Paula kind of earned her stripes, and now after a certain amount of time, you say, yeah, okay, now we can trust that we can work together as equals.
The relationship started. We were friends at camp. We knew that we enjoyed working together. We knew that our skills were complementary. The internship created a relationship of trust. But I would say, if you spoke to Ariella, or if you spoke to Dahlia, or if you spoke to any other people who've interned at the synagogue, that we give trust. We want to trust. We don't want to err on the side of not trusting. We'd rather make the mistake and let our guard down and create something that's lasting and that's really productive for everybody than to put up our guard. And I think that the mentorship relationship runs both ways. And we saw that very early on, that I could learn from her and she could learn from me. And the trust got established pretty quickly. I trusted from the outset that she would be someone that I could count upon. I didn't have to worry about that. Were there areas that needed growth? Sure. Did she show me areas where I needed growth? I'd like to think so, because we all have them, and it isn't until you have that mirror that you can see yourself in a clearer fashion. So the relationship was one of growth, but there was never a question from the outset of whether she was going to love the community as much as I did. You know, I it was my baby, but carry my baby, please. You know, I wasn't afraid to let her have the baby.
But Ravi, there was a rolling out that happened just by course. In other words, when I started, the synagogue found this little bit of money, and I was part-time, fellow women, I was a part-time rabbi. And so the other part-time, I stayed at Golda Ak working, and it was a pretty, like, split, kind of crazy existence. And then I became less part-time, but I still, and I think this is really key, I wasn't every Shabbat in the shul. I was still really living fully my life back in Caldwell, New Jersey, and still very active in my synagogue there, and my kids were really growing up at that point and still in Golda Ach themselves, etc. And by the way, interestingly, this is a measure in terms of maternity leave, paternity leave, and our shul. It never said in my contract, Rabbi Drill will be here X number of Shabbatot, Rabbi Drill will. I just started coming more often because it became my spiritual community. I just needed to be there to the point now where I don't even build a sukkah in Caldwell anymore. I come up and we live in Craig and Nancy's sukkah because I just couldn't miss the chagim anymore. It's now my community. I was home for Passover in Caldwell and everyone was very shocked and trying to remember my name. And so, yeah, that's right. Yeah, no, the kippah's a dead kid. So as it rolled out, Craig then went on sabbatical. So I had 6 months where I was the only game in town. And I found a new voice. I found more strength. I found a different level of confidence in the places where, like, you know, he just knows everybody's Hebrew name. I can't even call them up, and he just knows their Hebrew name. I had to start, you know, I couldn't just seed over the whole Torah service to him on Thursday morning. I had to get in there, I had to find a Torah reader, do the Torah reading. I couldn't just let go of it because it's so natural for him. And I think since the sabbatical, it's a different level of equality in the synagogue. And by the way, when I took over during the sabbatical, that's the point in negotiations where I said, no more associate. It was already clear that I wasn't the associate anymore. I was really his partner. But then I said, okay, I'm going to work during the sabbatical, but I'm his co-rabbi.
By the way, I would say that the sabbatical was a good lesson for me, too. That you really need to be able to let go. And I learned better balance. And balance is something we haven't addressed this, but balance is something that's very interesting in terms of our own families, because I'm better at balance than she is. And I need to remind her to go home or to see her kids or to, you know, take the days off or whatever the case may be. And I learned during sabbatical that the place can run without me. And that was a really healthy lesson to have.
So, do you relate to congregants differently physically?
We're very touchy.
We're both huggy kissy. Yeah.
That's good.
We are.
Yeah.
But there are moments that it's not appropriate, and she'll say something to me because she's not comfortable, you know, fending off somebody. And, you know, during the procession on Shabbat morning, I'll push through.
Yeah.
And I'll run interference because I don't want this guy grabbing her. And he likes grabbing her as she walks in the procession.
I'm working currently in a very different role. I'm not the associate rabbi. I'm the educator, congregational educator. But we have different physical styles, and I'm very heavy, and he's not. And I think it's in that particular area puts him at a disadvantage. So it's not a problem with you, but I wonder if it's an issue.
Yeah. It's interesting because my male cantor is very huggy, and I'm a germaphobe, so I don't usually, like, there's a...
It doesn't matter.
It's a chapter.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. But,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
Especially after I see them sneeze and then they put their hand up.
First of all, obviously you have an amazing, like, your good friends and your personality obviously lend itself to this relationship, which, like you said, is aside from gender, it's the personalities working together. But since you have this great model, it's how do you teach this model, right? And again, whether it's rabbi, rabbi, and cantor, now what do you do with it? Right? To show that this is great, I'm sure, I mean, how to work with synagogues, corporate, but like, for more, I can imagine this thing, this is great, I'd love to do this, but now, what do I do?
I'm so glad you asked that.
So, can I let Ariella answer this?
Sure.
Because Dahlia, you know, Dahlia, we knew each other a long time before you became our intern, so we were friends already. So you can't really answer this question. I didn't know you from a hole in the wall.
Right.
So when you came to the show.
How do you teach it?
How do you teach it?
How do you teach this model of trust and friendship?
Sharing. So, I mean, a lot of it was the
I just like follow them everywhere. Like, and that was what Paula was saying also, but it was a lot of, they were both really open about inviting me in to just see and then process after and let me ask questions. I was invited to call something out if I noticed it. I think of like one or two instances in particular now. So I think it was really just a, I was invited to ask, like, was that intentional, what you did just there? And if it was, then to be able to understand why, and if it wasn't, to give them an opportunity to think about, you know, was there actually intentionality there that might not have been so conscious at that point, but maybe was at another point. So I think, you know, you were very upfront with me. Craig was my official mentor, but I got to be mentored by both Craig and Paula, which was wonderful. But I think, and Craig in particular, when we, like, set this whole thing up, said that, you know, you laid out the transparency from the beginning to say, ask questions, push back, and we want you to be in for anything that you can be in to really understand it. So I think that's, I mean, that's how I learned it. And to be seen as, that's something I can implement in the, I also.
And now you'll go off and do yourself. I just wanted to say that on a broader scale than just intern by intern each year, Craig and I for years now have been saying, this model is healthy. This model works. This is really important for people to know about. Then we say something along the lines of, but it's just unique because we were the Craig and Paula show at Camp Ramah and Nyack long before we became rabbis together in a congregation. And I just, right before we started, I turned to him and I said, you know, maybe this invitation from the RA is just the catalyst we need for us to try to call out what are those pieces that we could write about to say this is how you do the balance, this is how you bring the man and the woman together, or the older and the younger, or whatever it is to women.
My concern is that if we're insecure about who we are, where we are, then we're never going to open up to others. We're never going to share transparency. And if we're healthy, if we're secure, then we have the luxury of being able to say, I'm asking you to be an open book with me because I'm going to be an open book with you. And that's why I say this has to be with cantors and rabbis or with co-rabbis, whatever the case may be. What I say to all the students, you know, if you get a sense, you walk into a new community and you're going to be hired as the assistant or the associate and your senior doesn't see himself or herself as a colleague and a mentor, well then you're not going to be there long because we need to be chaverim. We have to be chaverim if we're going to be models for our communities and hope to see them emulate the same.
Let's go down the road, starting with Dahlia.
So actually, I have something to add just about that model because after I finished my two internships and then I went out into the world, I kind of felt like, well, now I've been spoiled for all congregations ever and all professional relationships ever. But that's not true. But one thing that when Craig went on sabbatical, I got a chance to be just with Paula for part of the time. And for me, what came out of that relationship was depending on one another. And I thought that was really, I felt like I was invited to step up because there were spaces and needs for me to step up. And so therefore I grew and I think our relationship grew also even though we had a relationship before then. And I think depending on colleagues is a really challenging thing because when you do that, then you open yourself up to say, well, I have needs and I can't do everything by myself. And we tend to not want to have to say that. But being able to depend on one another was really valuable. And then it just kind of grew from there.
Our work is so hard. Why would we not want someone to lean on, someone to share it with? It just doesn't make sense. We lost a 20-year-old to a suicide a week and a half ago. To go through it alone, to not be able to share your struggles and your dark moments, why would you want to be alone in that regard? And so it just doesn't make sense that we have colleagues who aren't looking to share their experience and to make themselves vulnerable in a way that helps them get through it in the long run.
And the word that hasn't been said here yet is vulnerability, which Dahlia just alluded to, which both of us are very willing to make ourselves vulnerable. I'm a big believer in the work of Brené Brown and Vulnerability as a Strength. She's one of my heroes. And I'll just give an example of that. I mean, one of the many ways in which Dalia Bernstein saved my life, literally and figuratively, was that I came into the rabbinate as an older person. I mean, I started rabbinical school at 39, so I had already learned how to lane as an adult, but my Torah reading is never going to come as simply to me and as easily to me, and I'm never going to be as calm about it as Craig, who has been laning since he was a kid. It's more, this isn't a gender thing, this is just an experiential thing. So I'm able to model for my community. I still come to the Torah. I love to come to the Torah. It is hard for me. And I think that that's not only important in a working relationship, but in our communities, to let our congregants know, like, there's things that are hard for your rabbi. There are experiences that don't come naturally. We don't have every answer to everything. So.
I just think that what you're really alluding to is really the key to the whole thing. Because if you realize that you're not a superhero, and you check the ego that we all have, and keep it, you need it for certain things, but you need to understand it, right? You're able to be humble and be able to have that relationship. Then everything really, the partnership and everything flows from there. And in fact, actually, even the gender stuff that we talked about, even, let's say, acknowledging or saying, you know, hey, maybe actually this Rosh Chodesh thing you can do in a way that I just can't do it. If you have that ego and defense in it, you can actually even, you can't say that.
I'm a little jealous that I can't be a part of that experience. Right.
But you have to be able to have the friendship, the trust, the vulnerability, the partnership, commitment to be able to do that. So I think whether you're talking about the male versus female, you know, a lot of it has to do with, you have the advantage in terms of friendship and trust and all of that. But for people, in terms of the belief question of translating it, I think part of translating it is, we call them social work, naming issues, right? And naming from the beginning about the transparency and the trust and the respect and the kind of relationship that you're trying to create. You know, so that if you can name that with your partner, co-rabbi, sister, rabbi, so whatever you want to call them, right? Then you have a shot at trying to create this kind of model.
And I think with a cantor, too.
Yeah.
Anybody?
Sorry,
Jonathan, did you have a question?
This has been quite a lot. I kind of feel like Chalmi Hamahel. I finished the seminary in 1970, and I met Aliyah 31 years ago. So this is like a whole different world. And this is kind of, as I mentioned, this is like post-gender. Now we got that behind us. What's the sun? What's next? And the question is, how are we going to stay alive as a movement? How are we just politically, but how are we going to position ourselves to serve the needs of what we believe are like a lot of American Jews? Things aren't as terrible as people say they are, because there are people who want to identify with us, who don't want to be Orthodox, not Reform, or the us. And how can we serve them? And you're giving us models to kind of go forth, which I think is very important. One thing that just comes to mind, even though this is revolutionary for us, the Christian clergy, I think the Protestants have been doing this for a long time. They have they have 8,000 members, and they have a whole staff, and my sense is that they have some Torah to teach us also. If we do this, like, besides the wonderful uniqueness of this, it's almost idiosyncratic, because you both come with such huge strengths, which come through in fragile voice, which is terrific. If we really do this seriously, or in terms of replication, I'd like to consult with what the Protestants are doing, and say, how's this work? How can we look this up? And I'm also favoring it as splitting the salary package. That's the bottom line. The day you arrive, you sell yourselves by becoming served by your partners. But not that self.
She's done with college. I still have two more to go. So after that, we'll discuss.
So I want to take two quick questions because I saw that Annie and Michael had their hands up.
Sure. On websites and on promotions, is it always alphabetical order? Do you purposely swap the order that the rabbis appear?
Craig goes first. I've never thought about that before. Someone has to go first. I don't know. Funny.
Yeah, that's a good question.
And he was there first, I guess.
And Shabbat sermons, you just alternate?
We alternate. We alternate. And in fact, you know, that was one of those transition items. That when Paula started, there were some people saying, wait, we're not going to hear you speak every week? And like, no, you're not. She's coming once a month, you know? Once a month, she'll give a talk. They'll have me 3 months. And then before long, it was, you know, it was twice a month. And then it was just, we're alternating. And the community grew into it. They realized that she had what to say, and she's a pretty good speaker in her own right. And so it was really, it was a relief for me, and a very smooth transition for the community.
And Annie? My question had to do with relationships with other staff members of your school. Do you have an executive director? And I'm not sure what sort of the staff... stats are and how you work with your other staff and supervises them.
Yeah. We have a very small staff. We have Krista. Krista, you know, before it was Christine, and before that it was Christopher. Crazy. No, it's strange. Krista is our office manager / administrator. We don't have an executive director. Huh. We have a part-time bookkeeper and a part-time receptionist. And the two of us, an education director and a youth group.
Full-time education director?
Pretty full-time.
And do you supervise all of those staff members, or do they?
Do we supervise them? Krista doesn't answer to us. We give input.
We beg from her.
We answer to her. Krista's been with us 13 years, so she's part of the family. How do we relate to her? Pretty much the same, you know. She's family. She calls us Rabbi, but
actually, she called.
Well, that's your fault.
That's my. I'm Paula, and he's Rabbi Shep. Just an interesting little point. It's very interesting.
In part, it stems from that internship stage, yeah, you know, where she was Paula and not Rabbi. And there are some people who call her Rabbi Paula. Yeah. And again, that's your thing. I mean, that's.
Yeah, I don't. There's so many things to get hung up on that I don't care what they call me, but Rabbi needs to be in front of it. Mm-hmm. But I don't care.
Do you have a way to talk about her? How do you refer to
Rabbi Drew.
And Rabbi Shep, for sure. For sure.
Do you have a lot of volunteers who do things like developments, fundraising, that volunteers
for that? We do. We have a lot of volunteers. We're both pretty good at getting people into place and then letting them go. She tends to be more interested in continually being part of it, where I'm happy to be someone they report to. But, you know, committees will call upon either one of us to be present. We have a new inclusion committee, and they'll CC us and they'll say, can one of the rabbis be there? It's not in a sense that it belongs to one or the other, just
well,
can one of you be there?
Executive director, as opposed to having an executive director. That's just not, it's wonderful to hear that in a congregation at large that your people can...
We're conscious of the fact that we split the job of an executive director between our office administrator, the two rabbis, and the president. Mm-hmm. The president.
So as we near the time that we're supposed to close, if you can give any closing thoughts that you guys have, and then I'll conclude.
I'll go first, do the last.
You go first, second.
Keep thinking. closing thoughts.
Look, I like to have the last word.
She rarely gets it. She likes to have it. We love to play together, and we see the challenge of teaching Torah as something that can be quite pleasurable in what we do. And I don't necessarily believe that that is gender based. I believe that that is the fact that we believe in what we're doing. And I've always said, just based on my experience with Paula, who brings many gifts to our community, that I would hope that all of us could just be more open about our relationships with our colleagues, that we all benefit from the success of one another. And that's true in our own synagogues, it's true in our communities, it's true in between synagogues, that ultimately the Jewish people are going to be benefited by our ability to share the different ways in which we bring Torah to those people. And in return, I've been personally enriched by it. To have a partner to work with who cares about me and who watches out for me, who will remind me when I'm being self-destructive in any way whatsoever. Not that I have another mother, but that I have a partner. Somebody who wants to know that I'm going to be there for the long term and who's going to be there to relieve her when she needs a period of support. And I just think that that it's achievable, that it's not a pipe dream. I really believe that it's achievable if only we start soon and from the top down, recognizing that things like constitutions and contracts have to reflect our needs as professionals, which means recognizing that we need partnership, not hierarchy. And the longer we perpetuate the model of hierarchy, the more destructive we are to our relationships and to our longevity and the roles we try to play.
I'll add so briefly that here we are celebrating 30 years of women in the rabbinate. I remember when we celebrated the first 120 women in the rabbinate. And so maybe it's getting toward the time when we need to be less conscious, but I still am very conscious of myself as one of the early generation. I'm not the first generation, but of women, it's still unusual. And to do the work sometimes can be heartbreaking as a woman, but to have a male colleague who's such a staunch ally makes it not only possible, but the best job I could have ever dreamed up for myself in the world. I love my work.
Yasha Koch to both of you. Truly inspiring. We could replicate you guys, and Craig, I need your phone number because you're like little Bill Lebo.
I can hear the Lebo, Rabbi Lebo just coming out of you, and I don't know how many times I have called him in the last month.
And I think that Rabbi Schwab, I don't remember your first name, Joel. I think you were the one who said this, that we really need to focus on the holy work that we do. Is that you?
Yeah.
And I think that that's so important in all that we do. I remember at a rabbi's meeting in Chicago when I worked, I said that I answered to God, and they all laughed at me. But I still feel like we need to put God in the picture in that holy work, and for sure, listening to the two of you, there's God and Kedusha in everything, and a different type of Kedushin, but definitely a holiness in your relationship as well. I want to thank Alana and Jim also for all that they put into this. And let's conclude with a little prayer for Alana and the community and for all of us. Oh,